Welcome to AMAT's Transportation Talk, a podcast that focuses on transportation happenings in the greater Akron area. Our guest today is Valerie Shea, Planning Director of Metro RTA in Akron. We talk demographics, bus rapid transit, and the future. All right. Well, welcome to our inaugural AMATS podcast. I am Curtis Baker with AMATS, and today our guest is Valerie Shea from Akron Metro RTA. Welcome, Valerie.
Hi, Curtis. How are you?
I'm good. And so, first of all, thank you for being here. We're really excited that trying to find our first guinea pig to test our podcasting and see if we have any talent at this whatsoever. But we thought it would be really important for this region to really have an opportunity to find out more from professionals that are working in the Akron area, what they're trying to get done when it comes to transportation, whether it's infrastructure, bikes and peds, or obviously transit. And so we're excited to have you and really, you know, want to explore some of the things that maybe I think when people are going to a public meeting or when they're just kind of, I don't know, reading minutes if people do that, finding out what they really can get a little bit more information, get a little bit more in depth. So I thought that what we could first start off with maybe, Valerie, is if you just want to talk a little bit about what you're up to, like what's going on at Metro RTA right now and what are the exciting things that we're looking forward to.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be the first guest. Hopefully this goes well for you and you can have many more. I'm not making any promises.
Right, absolutely.
But no, we're up to a lot at Metro. One big initiative we have going on right now is we are getting ready to update our strategic plan. So we, in the beginning of 2020, we'll be kicking that process off. And the goal is to kind of redefine what the future of Metro looks like over the next 10 years. What are our goals? What's the mission for the organization? And then how do we align our goals and objectives with resources to make sure that we can get some of those short-term and longer-term priorities accomplished? So that's a big initiative.
Now, in my world, when we say we're doing long-range planning, we're talking out to, right now we're talking out to 2045. So when Metro RTA thinks about long-range planning, what's really your time scale in there? What kind of horizon are you looking at?
Sure. So for this particular plan, we're really just talking less of a long-range plan, more of a 10-year, 5 to 10-year plan. We're being really specific to that we want near-term and, you know, 10-year-term goals that are actionable, that have clear performance metrics attached to them so that we can track our progress. And we don't want to create a plan that's just sitting on a shelf. We want to create a plan that we are actually aligning what we do as an organization with that plan every day.
So now that, because you've been in your position now since 2016, correct?
Yes, the beginning of 2016.
Okay, so, yeah, so
2017.
Okay, yeah. 2017. So yeah. Now 3 years in, or two and a half, whatever it is, like what do you see as sort of low-hanging fruit? What are some things when you look at this visioning and strategic planning that you think, hey, we can do this and we can probably do it pretty easily?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of things that we need to make sure that we're looking towards the future on. It's not a low-hanging fruit, but one thing, you know, we've operated our bus network in pretty much the same way for the past 20 years, which has served us well and served the community well. But as we're kind of have this eye on the future, we need to make sure that the service that we're designing is being responsive to the changing development patterns and travel patterns and needs of our community. So part of that strategic planning process will make sure that we are keeping up with the times and looking, you know, even one step ahead to make sure that we're able to provide different mobility options. Look at how our bus network currently operates. Is that what people need or does that need adjusted? So those are kind of bigger ideas, but I think we have to start looking at the big picture and then take small steps to get there.
Right. So I think almost kind of pushing that theme even further, like let's talk about demographics, ridership right now. I mean, unfortunately, Northeast Ohio in general and the Akron area as well, although I know there's a lot of efforts to push population growth, you know, statistically, we've not really been performing well compared to, say, cities like Columbus and even Grand Rapids, et cetera. What are the main demographics that you're seeing, especially just right now with ridership? I mean, I think you and I were even emailing back and forth a few weeks ago about how it seemed like there was this big peak in ridership in the early, mid-2000s mm-hmm. maybe, and mm-hmm. since then it's sort of tailed off. And I'm just curious about when you're looking at that and you're thinking about the demographics for visioning, what do you see as sort of the main red flags, if you will, or things where you're saying, oh, we really got to make sure that we're covering our bases on this, because in 5 years, 10 years, it could be a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to make sure that we have an eye on being a travel option of that is something that is convenient and readily available. We have part of what our strategic plan is doing is an onboard survey, and mm-hmm. so that'll get a lot more detailed demographic information about our riders. The last one we did was in 2013. So what we found from that is we have a lot of riders who are dependent on us and who we might be their only form of transportation to get to work, or maybe they have one car in their household with two employed adults in the household. So what our goal is to make the transportation system work for everybody in the community. And to do that, that means we have to be reliable, we have to be dependable, we have to be fast, and we have to be a good alternative to getting in the car. So I guess I don't know if I'm answering your demographic question mm-hmm. as well, but I think that this origin destination survey that we're doing is really, and the onboard survey is really going to be telling to make sure that we're really understanding how our system is being used right now.
Right.
And then making sure that we are making changes that reflect what those existing needs are, mm-hmm. Rather than kind of being reactive.
Right. Yeah, because I think one of the things, obviously, almost you need to know who's riding so then you can look at your demographics and say, okay, well, if we know that this population group or these people are taking advantages of our services, then they're going to be hit even harder if, say, like thinking about things like the silver tsunami that people call, or the, right. you know, just the aging of our county, how much that plays a role. What do you think when you look at your demographic, or when you look at your ridership data, mm-hmm. what do you see when you look at year to year and fluctuations? Like, do you think there's anything that really plays into it, whether it's, you know, how much weather even can play a role, or, you know, what do you think causes somebody to maybe, especially when we're talking about choice riders, like, mm-hmm. what do you think are there the detriments to saying, you know what, I just want to take my car today versus get on the bus?
I think so many factors go into it. We did, like you mentioned before, we did see kind of a peak in ridership in the early 2000s. Then it dipped off again with the economic downturn in, you know, 2008 to 2010. And we've gained a little bit back since then, but we've been right around like the 5 million rides a year mark since then. You know, every year it goes up a couple percent or down a couple percent, but we've really tended to stay for the past, you know, 7 or 8 years right around that 5 million mark. So much goes into it that, you know, larger scale economic changes in the region, gas prices go into that as well. If you're looking at transit as an alternative to your car, the job market is a huge factor. Most of our trips that people take on transit are to get to a job or to mm-hmm. get to school. So as those things change, ridership changes as well. Weather changes, like you said too, you know, you might not be making that extra trip to the grocery store that week if you, for something special, right. if it was raining outside or snowing really hard.
Okay, so when we're thinking about demographics too, maybe we should talk a little bit more about older folks or people that are aging and people that might not be using your fixed line service. I mean, obviously, it's kind of alluded to, counties getting older. So what are the services that are available to those folks, and what are you seeing in terms of their usage of those services?
Yeah, sure. So we have a couple of types of demand response service, which is the door-to-door service. We have our SCAP program, which is pretty well known throughout the county. That's available for seniors to make certain trips to get them from their house to a medical appointment or something like that. We also have our ADA complimentary service, which is essentially if we have a fixed route, a big bus that goes on that road at a certain time of day, then we also offer door-to-door service for someone who might not be able to make it to the bus stop within a quarter of a mile, or I'm sorry, three-quarters of a mile of any fixed-route bus stop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those are the two major buckets that we offer in our demand response, and we've definitely seen growth in that over the past couple years, and we expect that to continue to grow, mm-hmm. Which I'm glad that we're able to provide that service, especially, you know, federally mandated is only the three-quarter right, mile buffer right. ADA service, mm-hmm. and we provide the SCAT service in addition to that because we feel that that is a great benefit for our community. But it is, at, for just purely from an economic standpoint, it's a much higher cost per passenger trip for Metro to operate. So we're trying to make sure that we're able to sustain that service as much as possible, but also doing things to make our fixed route service even more accessible. Our fixed route buses are all ADA accessible with the ramps and lifts and everything, but we're looking to make improvements in the public right-of-way. So maybe, you know, your grandmother might choose to take the bus if she had a sidewalk to get to the bus stop mm-hmm. or, you know, it wasn't so bumpy or she had a shelter to protect herself from the elements while she was waiting for the bus. So we're looking to make improvements to bus stop amenities and partnering with municipalities on sidewalk improvements as well to try to get as many people on the fixed route service as we can, but making sure that we're still offering the demand response for those who need it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the things as a government agency, as Metro is, as AMATS is, et cetera, like we always might be a little late to the game when it comes to technology. But you guys now have jumped into mobile ticketing, and I honestly think that that's just fantastic for someone that isn't always near somewhere where I could buy a bus ticket. So maybe talk a little bit about that, how the rollout began, I think, what, 2-3 weeks ago?
Yep.
And so you're starting to see some usage, I'm assuming. Maybe just yep. talk us through that and how it's working so far.
Yeah, so we launched the mobile ticketing app, which is called Easy Fare. We did a soft launch in August. That was just, the tickets were just for the NCX, our commuter trips up to Cleveland. So we saw really good usage on that. On our highest usage days for our NCX riders, we saw about 30% of the boardings were using mobile ticketing to board.
Really, so, already?
Yeah, already, wow. Yeah. So the commuters really mm-hmm. adopted that pretty quickly. So then in October, just this a couple weeks ago, we had Tri-Transit Week, and in conjunction with that week, we rolled out mobile ticketing for all of our tickets that are available. So that app is called Easy Fare. Something that's unique about that is we actually partnered with through NeoRide, which is the Council of Governments, which with is different transit agencies throughout Ohio and even Northern Kentucky now. There's over a dozen transit agencies on the Easy Fare mm-hmm. app, so you can download.
Right, because a couple of our sister RTAs are on that.
Yes,
program
PARTA,
as well,
right? SARTA, Youngstown, Sandusky, mm-hmm. all the way down. Then, like I said, in Cincinnati, SORTA, and Northern Kentucky mm-hmm. as well. So, that was a really great partnership and initiative. So you just need one app, and you can select all those different agencies to buy tickets, and then you just purchase your ticket, and you show the bus operator when you board the bus that you have an active ticket, and they mark you on the fare box, and you can sit down and you don't have to fumble with change or hold
right.
up the people behind
right.
you.
Or worry about getting that dollar nice and crisp so it
right,
slides
right,
in there.
Right.
Talk a little bit more about how that works with the driver identification, because I know the one thing that I was a little taken aback by was like, oh no, they don't scan it, they just look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, how do they know that that's current and not being something that I've used already 3 times today? Maybe talk through what
sure.
that visual actually looks like.
Yeah, so we wanted to start off with visual validation just to kind of do a quick proof of concept and make sure that this was something that our community was going to be behind and that they would like, so it's a little less of an upfront capital cost to do the visual validation. But yeah, so you buy the ticket. There's we specifically, when we were looking at different vendors for the mobile ticketing, made sure that there were lots of fraud protection put into the tickets, just because we want to, obviously we have a responsibility to make sure that people aren't duplicating tickets and whatnot. So when you activate the ticket, there's 3 colored bars that change in different intervals. The time and the date scroll back and forth on the screen. So if you took a video of it, that time and date would obviously be wrong. Can't take a screenshot of it
because
you know it's not moving. So there's a lot of features that are built into it that ensure that our operators can easily tell if that's a valid and active ticket or not. So.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really awesome feature, and I think I'm looking forward to using it more, especially when I have the ability to ride more. Moving on into a completely different realm and kind of maybe jumping off from the strategic vision and the future, I want to talk a little bit about bus rapid transit. I think we've been talking about it locally for a little while now, and it's something that I've always thought has been, very successful as an alternative to rail, light rail, subway, costs, et cetera, because you're sharing infrastructure. But I guess before I go much further, maybe you could just tell us what Bus Rapid Transit is and how you think it would work here.
Sure. So Bus Rapid Transit is one of these mobility options that we're looking at for the county. So what it is it's a rail-like bus service, but it is not rail. So it's high-frequency service. So the buses would come at least probably every 10 minutes, 15 minutes perhaps in the off-peak or on the weekends. Those buses oftentimes are for majority of the corridor would run in their own lanes, so dedicated lanes. The stops and stations are a little bit farther apart than your typical bus line, maybe a quarter mile to more towards a half a mile apart. So you might have to walk a little further, but when you get there, it's a really substantial station. There's for sure shelter, there's likely real-time information, it's level boarding, so when the bus pulls up, the ramp doesn't need to employ a deploy. If you're in a mobility device, you can just get right on the bus. Other features that are added into it are like off-board fare payment, so you can pay with a ticket vending machine or have your mobile ticket active and ready to go, and then you can just board the bus on any door. You don't have to interact with the fare box, which saves time and helps make those travel times a little more reliable, which is a big feature of Bus Rapid Transit. Part of that is partnering with the municipalities that corridor would run through to make sure that there's traffic signal priority for buses. So basically that just means when a bus approaches an intersection, the light would stay green longer, or there'd be a dedicated signal for the bus to go through the intersection, as well as cars in the adjacent lanes to keep them moving and save some travel time.
Yeah, and I think from a user's perspective, I mean, the way that I've seen it work, or at least understand it to work in other places, is that it really almost feels like you're getting on a subway or a light rail station. I mean, everything from what I've seen, the way that the maps are portrayed, to just like you said, buying tickets and then walking up to this platform, being a platform instead of walking up the steps of the bus, all that. All of it seems like, just from a user's experience, it's a lot friendlier, easier experience for people to kind of jump onto. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the other things that I was looking at, too, was there was a study saying that, you know, people are willing to walk further if they think the station is covered, or, you know, at least providing some of those amenities that is different than just, like that stake in the ground sort of thing.
And plus, you might be willing to walk a little further if you know that when you get there, a bus is going to be there in less than 10 minutes. You know, that makes it a little, you know, if you have to walk a couple more blocks, it might not be so bad. But one of the big things, just to kind of put a little bit of perspective on it with improving that travel time, there's lots of examples of BRT that have gone throughout our country and throughout the world, but there's lots of great examples in the U.S., and a lot of them see, you know, typically for a regular bus route, we'll see like the number one. Average speeds on the number one are probably about 12 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Not very fast.
And the number one is the West Market.
The West
Street.
Market, yes, yeah. One of our highest ridership bus routes. So other BRT lines see improvements of up to 15 miles per hour, which when you're just saying 12 to 15 miles an hour, it doesn't really sound like a lot faster. Mm-mm. But for a passenger on that bus, most BRT lines are about 10 miles long, so that would be the difference between a 50-minute travel time and a 40-minute travel time on that corridor. So you're really saving 20 to 25% of your travel time, getting it sped up. You're not worrying about having to park or, you know, and then walk to your building. You're just getting, like, hopefully getting right off right in front of where you work or your grocery store and walking over and then getting back on the bus.
Now, for a lot of these places where they've done it, I'm assuming that most of the time it's replacing an existing route. Mm-hmm. So you do have to deal, I think, a little bit with that feedback of what stops you know, what stops are going to be the primary stops and which ones are the minor or not stops at all, I guess, that were, you know, formerly. What is the rule on that? What's the idea of distances between stops? I mean, you were saying kind of a half mile, but I was assuming that there'd be certain, like, logical points of termini for stops as well.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you're not just going to draw a line and then measure exactly a half a mile and put a stop at each of those places. You want your distances to be somewhere between a quarter and a half mile so that you aren't stopping at necessarily every block, but you're looking at where those nodes of activity are. Maybe there's another bus route that crosses the corridor and goes in a different direction, so you want to make sure there's a stop there so that people can transfer between buses and allow those opportunities, you know, major employers, downtown grocery stores, things like that. All of that goes into account, as well as just lane configuration, right-of-way availability, mm-hmm. and all those more boring things. But
all those boring but absolutely essential things,
exactly,
right,
yes.
that make a difference.
Right.
So how do you see Metro RTA pursuing this? You know, what are sort of the steps if people are interested or excited? I mean, typically it seems like these things do take a little while and do require a lot of planning. So talk a little bit about what's underway and mm-hmm. go from there.
Sure. So it's a partnership building opportunity. We can't do this alone, and we need partners around the table to be able to be successful at this. And I think that in almost every application of BRT throughout the country, that would be the case. So we are right now working with a few municipalities throughout Summit County on identifying corridors that could have a potential for bus rapid transit. And really talking, first step is really talking about what are the benefits. You know, I always say this, but nobody besides me, because I'm a transit nerd, gets on the bus to get on the bus.
Right.
People get on the bus to go to work. They get on the bus to, you know, go from their home to the grocery store, go to a medical appointment. And, you know, we don't have anything directly to do with what the land use and development
right.
patterns are along different corridors throughout the county. So we need to work with the city of Akron. We need to work with the other municipalities to make sure that we're planning a corridor that aligns with their goals
right.
and that their economic development efforts are aligned. You know,
right.
let's identify a corridor that we all see potential in, that, you know, between the land that's available, the existing ridership that we see, the existing land use patterns that are out there that can really be bolstered by right. having this more high frequency.
It seems like you really have to have everybody in lockstep, because when you are talking about something, you know, 5 to 7 years out, even things like simple future resurfacings from a community or certain work that would be done on mm-hmm. Utilities, etc., all of that sort of needs to be taken into consideration. If it's like, well, hey, we are going to also put in these, you know, $1 million stations or whatever, how much they would cost in this location, things like that.
Much. Yeah. Not getting very many if they're.
Well, I mean, some of those, what is it? The Indianapolis was like a $96 million cost?
Sure, yeah,
like
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Know?
It could be like up to like $10 million a mile.
Yeah, $10 million a mile.
Could,
so
it could go more than that, but between 5 and 10.
All right, well, we'll cut that part out.
I'm happy to correct you.
I just really want that $1 million station with the sofas and, you know, leather sofa. Yeah,
right outside your door.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right outside my door. No, but I think that's, I think all of that is really good. And I think that one of the things that has surprised me in this process of just with you guys starting to talk about it, you know, including us, including municipalities, is, and I think, again, when you talk about just planning and planning nerdery, like how many people don't really understand what bus rapid transit is. And I think if you're trying to even get across to them what it is, the only example that I think most people are familiar with is you say, well, like the Healthline or Euclid Corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I know what that is. But I still don't get the sense that most people out there have ridden it. You know, but they at least are aware of when they're going to a baseball game from Akron to Cleveland that there's a road that they,
buses,
yeah, there's I don't know if I can turn right out of this lane, something like that. I get at least there's a sense of like, okay, it is, and I don't use this in a negative term, but it's disruptive from the standpoint of it's not your normal street.
Right.
So if you're looking to just kind of go with the flow and not think, well, the first time you see the Euclid Corridor, it's like, whoa, there's stuff in the middle of the road, and there's these new signage that maybe you're not familiar with, which obviously people that are going there all the time
mm-hmm.
are now familiar with it and know what's happening. But I feel like from our area, just being 35 miles south, we're still a lot less familiar with it than the folks up north.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Healthline is certainly a great example of what, you know, full-scale, all the bells and whistles BRT can be. They saw great return on investment in terms of development on Euclid Corridor from that. It's been operational for about 11 years now.
It's incredible that it's already been 11 years.
Yeah, I know. But there's also good examples in cities that are more similar size to Akron.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Cleveland is a little bigger than us.
Yeah.
Maybe
not
mightier, but
much,
they're
though,
just a little. but yeah, we like Eugene, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, Omaha, Nebraska is opening up a BRT line. So there's lots of peer cities, Grand Rapids, Michigan, that have seen success too in really making a big investment, still having the substantial stations and dedicated bus lanes, and seeing development happen around that too.
Yeah. And typically these things don't happen without some federal help, correct?
Right.
We're not talking about, you know, Metro RTA bonding $75 million so that
That's
they can build
goal.
This. Yeah. So I guess how do you see, you know, how do you see that playing out, and what kind of steps do you have to take to lay the groundwork even now for potential federal help to build a corridor like that?
Yeah, so the Federal Transit Administration, or FTA, is kind of our regulatory body in the federal government, and they have a grant program called their capital investment grants, or a small starts program, which is where a lot of BRT projects are getting funded. So you can apply to enter that program and get funded through that program, but of late, in recent years, to be successful in getting that award, you kind of have to come to the table with nearly 50% local match. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at a, you know, $50 to $70 million dollar project, that's still a lot of money that locally that right. we would have to
together
as well.
And I'm assuming that match, we're talking more like the project capital funding. We're not even talking about
operating,
running
right.
it.
Yep,
right?
Yep, that's just capital. Yeah. So, yep, operationally, I mean, it could cost a couple $1 million a year for...
And, you know, you talked about... So, I mean, obviously there's a huge cost, and I think some people might question... which I think is a fair question, but, you know, is this idea of, well, like, why not just do signal preemption? Because it's a lot cheaper and, you know, you're going to get the same bang for your buck, or at least that's the perception.
Sure.
How would you respond to that, or, you know, maybe even talk a little bit about some of the transformations? So I think Euclid Corridor is a great example of that, like mm-hmm. you were saying with the economic development. But how do you sort of fight that where the push is? Why don't we just increase more buses and do more headway?
Sure.
Or increase headways?
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely get some bang for your buck by doing that. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing to pursue in corridors where maybe bus rapid transit, the full-blown
right,
thing.
Right, because it's not going to be everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. Right. But like you were alluding to with the development, I mean, you can. There are peer cities out there, Grand Rapids, like I mentioned before, where you're seeing development happen around these stations because it represents a substantial public investment in public space that, you know, you can really create a place around. Mm-hmm. Transit-oriented development is something that you usually hear talked about around rail stations, but there's no reason that you can't do that, and it is happening throughout the country around BRT stations where the development is really going in because the transit is there and
Absolutely.
Being oriented to the transit. So, you know, there might be apartment buildings that go in and don't have any parking at all,
mm-hmm.
or very, you know, much below the parking minimums because they have the transit right outside their front door.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you've mentioned Grand Rapids a few times, and one of the things that I'm just curious about, because there have been, I don't know how many of these have been built throughout the country. I'm assuming it's at least dozens of
right.
BRT routes. Mm-hmm. And typically, you're not just building it to have the exact same ridership and service that
right.
you had before. So if you were going to set out to make an investment like this, what would you be looking for? What do you think would be the goals or the expectations or the hopes of an investment like this?
Yeah, I think a lot of the successful BRT lines are seeing increases in the order of like 20 to 30% in ridership on that corridor. So I would consider that a big success. I mean, it really is with transit, and especially with frequency and reliability, is if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a corridor with half an hour service or maybe not even service that's very regular, you can't really, without a paper schedule in front of you, you wouldn't know when the bus was coming next. That prevents a lot of people from getting on the bus or being able to use the bus to get to, you know, the start of their shift or something like that. So
mm-hmm.
the high frequency and reliability of a BRT line also just spurs more people to have transit as an option, where you can just walk up to the station and, like I said, you know a bus is going to be there in less
right.
than 10 minutes.
And with most of these stations, do you end up seeing kind of extended hour, or not stations, with these routes, seeing extended hours? So... You know, are you running a little later? Are you running on Sundays? Are you running on Saturdays?
Yeah, I would say almost all BRT lines have good frequency throughout the whole day, mm-hmm. during the week. Maybe pull back on the frequency a little bit on the weekends, mm-hmm. depending on the uses along the corridor, but definitely not going to much more than a 20 or 30 minute headway on right. Sundays. But yeah, 7 day a week service for sure.
Cool. So if we move, I guess, a little bit even further when we think about the future, and I think these are kind of interesting topics that maybe aren't even necessarily totally germane to Akron even yet, because we seem to be late adopters to all things. but I've almost started to hear, I think, almost a little bit of fatalism when it comes to transit from sort of like the techies or from, you know, futurists, so to speak, where there's sort of this, well, the autonomous car is coming, so mm-hmm. why do we need transit at all? When people, you know, a car will just drive everybody, or the same with Uber and Lyft. I mean, I feel like, you know, the call of transit or the prediction of transit's demise because of Uber and Lyft has been written by journalists and all this mm-hmm. stuff. And I think the reality is it's a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. But how do you see that shaking out? I mean, especially maybe we'll just start with like the Uber Lyft. I mean, are they competition? You know, I think from our perspective, it's like, man, it definitely generates a hell of a lot more trips when you've got, you know, cars just circling around waiting to right. pick people up. But how do you see it impacting transit maybe now and then 5 years from now?
I certainly don't see the transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft as a competition. It definitely can be complementary to transit. I know, you know, in my travels, if I go and take the train from the airport and then, you know, it might be early morning when my flight is out, I might take Uber back to the airport just because it's another option. Or so, it, you know, having more options on how to get around is always a good thing. I don't think it's ever going to, I don't subscribe to the doom and gloom mentality about public transit. You know, there's all those figures that you see of, you know, what 40 people on a bus looks like and how much space that takes right. up on the road compared to 40 people in a single occupancy vehicle mm-hmm. or 40 people in an Uber and Lyft or 40 people in an autonomous vehicle.
Right.
Still the same thing, still takes up a lot of space. So there's definitely those urban corridors that have a lot of density on them where these higher frequency bus routes are always going to be a good option and a reliable option and maybe the most reliable option in those situations. Now, that being said, we do, as a transit agency, need to make sure that we're responding to the trends and the demands, really, for how to get around in maybe the less dense areas of the county. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're looking at different mobility options. We're actually starting a pilot program called FlexRide
right.
that would work with suburban job hubs to get more demand response service of people who might be commuting from Akron to those suburban mm-hmm. job hubs rather than providing a fixed route service to get there that yeah. might not get them there on time for their shift.
Yeah.
So we just have to be reactive and we have to understand. We have to provide real-time information, which we do through our MyStop app and our website now. But that convenience factor has to be built into what we do as a transit agency as well. It's got to yeah. be easy.
Well, and I think it's interesting and when we talk about Uber and Lyft, and we've seen, I think especially it seems like it's been in Florida, but it's been in other places too, where the transit agencies start subsidizing mm-hmm. Uber and Lyft rides. And what I find troubling about those things is that I really do believe that, you know, when you're almost dancing with the devil, like you don't know where that data is going, you don't know how they're using it, how well will they share with you,
yeah.
and they're really for-profit corporations. And in that case, sometimes I wonder, especially when we're talking about our most underserved, mm-hmm. if those are the best folks to really move the needle
yeah.
forward, and especially when it comes to things like ADA.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I understand the concept of wanting to partner with other providers to maybe make those first and last mile
Right.
Trips.
The last mile connections are always seems like the biggest discussion.
Right. Right. But there are still some challenges that these early adopters of those partnerships are working through. One of them, the most major one being ADA, like you mentioned, is, you know, Uber and Lyft don't, there's not an option to say, I need an ADA accessible vehicle. And if, as a transit agency, we're partnering at all to provide that trip, we have to make sure that we have an ADA alternative available. So usually there's another, you know, either the transit agency themselves then has to be able to offer a trip to somebody who might be in a mobility device and, you know, requesting that same ride as they would on Uber or Lyft, or you have another third-party vendor in there and it's just not all of those nuts and bolts aren't totally worked out yet. There's also, you know, background checked and drug and alcohol testing that Uber and Lyft is not. I mean, a vast majority of those drivers are great.
Yeah,
you know, but there's just some regulations that aren't, you know, they're not a public transit company. So there's differences there. So I think there's definitely, they're promising partners, and more in recent years, even maybe in recent year, I've seen and heard them come to the table in the conversation and understanding the concerns around data sharing too, making sure that they're able to provide useful information. Because if we are partnering with them and we have no idea where those trips are going,
right?
We're not really understanding the needs that we're serving or not serving.
Yeah. No, I agree, and it seems like it's one of those things too that I don't really think those companies have yet shown to be profitable.
Right.
And so you just wonder, you know, sometimes I wonder if everybody's just still playing with fool's gold when it comes to this stuff, because it's incredibly expensive to drive a car around nonstop and get paid for it. And,
right.
you know, I just think there's still so much of the story to be written on that. On the more even futuristic side of autonomous vehicles and I guess even potentially autonomous buses, I feel like the stuff I've seen the most of are, you know, these shuttle buses that can drive themselves, but they only turn right and they're on like a special, you know, they're only on a special loop. And I'm not enough of a, you know, Luddite to say technology it's not going to happen or that autonomous vehicles aren't on their way. But I do still think there is that sort of almost like induced demand of, you know, if you can have your car drop you off and go somewhere else and do that, then you are talking about, like you were saying before, about space on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually putting more car miles on, you know, than there has been before. And it actually could have like a lot of different societal negatives that I think, you know, we sort of focus on. Well, like all the futuristic utopian
type aspects.
Well,
you think
of what
it would do for me personally,
right,
and not,
right.
you know, maybe the
But in reality,
the
it's like
picture,
you could actually have, you know, a heck of a lot more pollution, a lot more congestion on our roadways, et cetera, especially when we, say, have a fleet that's half and half.
Right.
Or something like that, like when you have half the people actually driving. But at the same time, like there seems like there are positives of it from a safety perspective. But even that, I guess, by personal view, and I don't know if you guys have talked about it strategically, even is I don't see that, like you were saying, being a major challenger to transit. Because I think, in a way, you could argue that actually self-driving cars are going to be even more expensive. And if they become the predominant mode of transportation, fewer people are going to be able to afford them now than, you know, than maybe what we expect, what car ownership's like today. Or even like subscription services, things like that. What do you think about it?
I mean, I think it's happening. I don't think there's anything that any of us are going to do to change that. I think the technology is probably actually the easiest thing to solve on that. It's a lot of the questions around, like you said, the transition of going from, you know, driver-occupied vehicles to autonomous vehicles. And some of, you know, you can go down a whole rabbit hole of, like, how does this car make a decision in, you know, the trolley dilemma or whatever know? So there's a lot of nuances that are still, you know, maybe more on the softer side of the technology needing to be figured out. But as far as how it relates to transit, I mean, autonomous buses are a thing that are also being developed. I don't think...
Yeah, have there been any transit agencies that have picked up on that you know of?
I mean, there's been the autonomous shuttles that you've discussed. Yeah. So, like, Columbus has one.
Is it run by COTA, or is it a private...
I think that is not run... Okay. I actually don't know off the top of my head, but I don't believe it's run by COTA. But, you know, there's... To me, and this is me speaking personally, I think there's always going to be the need for some sort of transit agency employee to be on a bus. Just from the space issue that I talked about earlier, there still are going to be corridors where it makes sense to have a larger capacity vehicle, like a public transportation vehicle, but you're still going to need someone to, you know, ensure fares are being collected, to help a mobility device get secured, to just be, you know, a authority figure on the bus, you know. So I think that the technology is coming and it's going to happen, but I don't know that it's going to totally upend what we do as a public transportation agency.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've seen some comparisons to it being almost the same as when the car was invented, and you know, there used to be this perception or belief, you know, before jaywalking, that basically the streets belong to all, and then over a course of, you know, multiple decades, you know, we, through lobbying, policy, etc., it became the streets are places for cars, and people are not supposed to cross wherever they want, they have to use crosswalks, etc. And you think about how, I don't think when those decisions were happening, we thought about how drastically that would change. I mean, really, car culture in the United States to where we are now. And so I am kind of curious to see, as autonomous vehicles develop and start taking over the roadways, like, are we going to make the same mistakes? Like, are we going to build all of this infrastructure around this fancy new technology all at the detriment of what? You know, almost like we don't even know what that is, but you know, and God hope it's not at the detriment of bicyclists, pedestrians, and transit operators as well. So, I think it's sort of an interesting thing to look for in the future, and especially as you know, whether it's a decade out or two decades out, what we really see happening could be, you know, hopefully not changing the vibrancy of the cities around us.
Right. Yeah, and I think a lot of the work that Drive Ohio is doing too, which is programmed through ODOT, which you're well aware of that. I think that they have a lot of people at the table talking, having those conversations. So I don't think anything's happening in a vacuum. I just do think there's a lot of unknown around it. But I know as a transit agency, we've had really good conversations with the folks at Drive Ohio about what that looks like for us.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, Val, I appreciate your time today, and thank you for being on our inaugural podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and hopefully we can do it again soon, and that'll wrap this up.
Awesome. Thank you, Curtis.
Thank you for listening to AMATS Transportation Talk. Keep an eye out for additional content by following us on Twitter at AMATS Planning and AMATSPlanning.org.